Maybe we could start with some biographical background.
On me?
Yes.
Okay. I was educated in Britain and came to this country to do a postdoc. I was actually offered a postdoc down at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, but I didn't do it because it didn't seem very interesting when I got here.
Really?
So I started looking for a job, and collaborative research offered me a position, mm-hmm. and I started working there in February of 1969.
Mm-hmm. You were a chemist.
I had a chemistry degree in organometallic chemistry, strange subject, but they had a collaborative had a big project with Gobind Khurana at MIT to synthesize the first tRNA gene, and they wanted chemists to work on the synthesis of nucleotides to make oligomers. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first job. I also looked up Gobind Khurana in your index, and it says he made the first gene in 1970. It says he's in Wisconsin, but he was at MIT at that time. When he did that.
Okay.
And we made all the building blocks. And then they used a different technique back then. They used ligase to stitch together all the blocks. Mm-hmm. So we had a big contract with the NIH to make the blocks. So we actually made gram amounts of them, huge quantities as well, because it was pretty inefficient stitching everything together back then. But that was my very first job, was making DNA.
And were you prepared for that job when?
No. Come on. Yeah. Back then, there were probably only a few academic labs who even were playing around with synthesizing DNA. I mean, 1969, mm-hmm. the 60s.
Right.
This is 10 years before recombinant DNA even existed.
Yeah.
But Ari Friedman, who was the founder of Collaborative, was an incredibly, I think, foresighted person. When I joined in 1969, Collaborative was working on three sort of main areas. One was trying to synthesize DNA, because Ari thought that being able to change sequences and make things would be important. We also were trying to grow mammalian cells, human cells, in culture to make the proteins that cells made, because he believed that if you're healthy, it's largely because your body makes all the right proteins in the right amounts, and a lot of diseases because either you didn't have the protein or you didn't make the right protein. Mm-hmm. And he thought getting normal human proteins by growing cells, that those proteins could then be used therapeutically. Remember, 10 years before recombinant DNA even existed, we were growing cells to do that. And I'll tell you a bit more about that. And then the third thing, we were working with antibodies, because we realized they were exquisitely sensitive at being able to pick something out. Now, again, this was polyclonal antibodies, because monoclonals were still way in the future. And so Collaborative developed the first radioimmunoassays and commercialized them, by the way, for biological molecules. It established cell lines that... The first commercial. I'm pretty sure we were the first commercial.
Yeah.
And we
because the insulin folks had done that, right? Did they use radioimmunoassays?
Well, radioimmunoassay was the technology that back then was using I-127 was the only tag you could put on molecules. So a lot of academic labs were developing assays for various things. But what we did was we actually made them for cyclic AMP, cyclic GMP. We also did LSD, THC, and we sold those as little kits that you could, so that anyone could buy them and run the assay in the lab. They didn't have to. So we sold largely to academic labs who did not want to, spend the time trying to develop their own antibodies and everything else.
Yeah. Listen, tell me about when you arrived in 1969. Tell me what, if you can recall, what you learned of the history, because I think 1961 was the founding date.
1961. So in 1969, from my memory, I may be wrong on this, there were probably about 30 or 40 people in the company. Mm-hmm. And Ari had founded it because he thought that a lot of the research done in academic labs was too academic. I mean, it was focused on getting publications, and it didn't have real-world applications. And when he talked with pharmaceutical companies, they were chemists, they did no biology, mm-hmm. and he thought that the research they did was, that their reaction to sort of the research he wanted to do was that it's too risky. We don't do risky stuff like that. So he saw the academic world over here doing very theoretical stuff, pharmaceutical companies who made products but weren't willing to take risks, and he realized you needed a company in between the two who was willing to do what academics thought was applied research. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember that word being used. It's applied research. We don't do that. You know, it's dirty stuff, you know, and a waste of time. And these big pharma companies who said, we can't do that. That's too risky. Mm-hmm. So we stepped right into the, he stepped right into the middle of that gap. Now, the challenge he had
purposefully.
That was the idea.
That
was his idea. And as I say, he thought of, you know, he was very thoughtful. He thought of, I'd never thought about the fact that, you know, human proteins, to use them as drugs, you needed to be able to make them,
yeah.
And that was a problem. The only human protein, the only proteins that were used as therapy back then were probably insulin, which was it was bovine and porcine insulin from the slaughterhouse. Urokinase was known of, but you could only get it in microscopic quantities out of human urine. Interferon was known, it was thought of as a magic molecule back there. It was going to be solve all sorts of medical problems, but only known in the sort of academic world because you couldn't make it.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, growth hormone was, I don't know when growth hormone was first used, human growth hormone was first used as a drug, but it was got from cadaver tissue from dead people until Creutzfeldt-Jakob surface. So there were very few proteins used other than insulin, really used therapeutically. But he had this vision that you're healthy, you make everything right, you make it in the right quantities, and people with diseases like type 1 diabetes, they're just missing the right protein. So we have to find ways of making them. And their proteins are too big and too complicated. You can't ever synthesize them, even though insulin was actually, it's a very small protein. Mm-hmm. But most proteins you can't. And so the only way to get them would be to grow mammalian cells and get them to grow in culture, give you a permanent cell line, mm-hmm. and at the same time keep producing the protein. So we were collecting tissue samples from patients in hospitals, taking biopsy samples of, for example, you know, different tissues, the pituitary to make human growth hormone. We had a cell line that made urokinase, which is another enzyme like TPA, it dissolves blood clots. And we had a number of targets like that. So HeLa cells was, again, obviously one of the places where that was successfully done. But so his vision was make human proteins, mm-hmm. because that's a new way of treating disease.
And were academics doing this in any substantial way? No.
No.
This was,
I don't believe at all.
Yeah.
I mean, remember this, they were interested like Gobind-Khorana in synthesizing genes. They were, at that point, we didn't fully understand tRNA genes. We couldn't even isolate messenger RNA. So all the things that you think of today, the knowledge wasn't, it was barely there that we knew proteins structure, we knew how they were made, mm-hmm. In cells, you know, DNA to RNA to protein, but that was about the level of information.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you could get a protein was find a tissue source like the tissues from the slaughterhouse and try and extract it,
mm-hmm.
and hope the protein might be useful. Or like urokinase, they collected urine from nuns in Italy because you want a nice, clean, reliable source that's not, you know, contaminated in any form for extracting things out of human urine. So those were the technologies that existed back then. So I think Ari was very foresighted because he had this vision of using human proteins,
mm-hmm.
and no one else in 1960s was talking about that.
So how did that progress? Did you have success growing up cell lines and harvesting proteins?
We did, with growth hormone and with urokinase. We didn't know at the time it was pro-urokinase. We now know it was pro-urokinase we were making. But
did you figure out a way to chemically treat it then?
Well, it actually happens. You give pro-urokinase to a human being,
oh,
their body
I see.
Will, in fact, convert it to urokinase. So. Another of the challenges, how do you fund that? back in that time period, okay?
So how did the company get started?
He put his own money in. His family had a lot of wealth. His father ran some paper or canning company in Canada. He was Canadian by origin, and his family had a lot of money, so he used his own money to start the company. And I'll even tell you, there were some time periods in the early 1970s where the company didn't have money to make payroll. He put his own money in those time periods. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm pretty sure it was his own money that got the thing going. Mm-hmm. But the way we were funding it in the sort of the late 60s when I joined, there were a lot of several government contracts. SBIRs didn't exist, they hadn't been invented. Mm-hmm. But we had some grants, which were hard to get being a company because the academics were all on the review board and they would all go, you know, we don't do that stuff. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have many grants, but we were able to get NIH government and NSF, NIH contracts.
And what were the contracts specifically for? Was it the idea that you're
producing materials
for them to...
So we had a contract with the NIH to make the starting materials for Gobind Khurana to stitch together to make a gene. He would go to the NIH and say, I need supply of these. So the NIH would put out an RFP, a request for a proposal, for a company to synthesize nucleotide building blocks to make genes. And of course, there were basically no companies doing that. We were probably the only one who even responded because he had already talked to us and knew we could do it. So it's like, you know, a bit of a three-ring circus there. But the government had to put out an RFP. We would respond, write a proposal, and then negotiate a contract with them to make those products. The other source of funding on the protein work, we went to the companies that might have an interest. So Organon funded, which was now doesn't even exist, but it's a pharmaceutical company that was based in Holland, and they funded the growth hormone work because they made a lot of fertility hormones and things like that. And then Abbott, a very early version of Abbott, funded the work on urokinase, and it eventually got commercialized as abokinase, ABBO kinase. So we were in this gap, as I said, between the two pieces of, you know, pharmaceuticals and academics, and it was a challenge to on the work, and it was a challenge on getting it funded. And that's where the company wasn't very big. I mean, 30 to 40 people from my memory. And we also had a big contract with the government to make some very complex intermediates that were used to make some pharmaceuticals that the NIH wanted, so tetrahydrofolic acid or something like that. So there was a group that synthesized very big complex pharmaceutical intermediates as well. So we would respond to any RFP that where we thought we could win it to get support for the various programs that we had. And that's also why we then commercialized things like the radioimmunoassays, because that was another means of bringing money in.
And you commercialize those in what form? A kit?
The RAAs were a kit. So after we got finished the contract,
specific kits for a specific set of antibodies.
Yes. Yes. So we supplied all the reagents. So, you know, even everything. So all your little kit with the labeled I-127 labeled markers, all the buffer solutions. You know, we set them up in little polystyrene kits with all the little bottles and everything. Complete set of instructions. All those sorts of things that you could do. We also started the whole. I mean, we started a research products division, but probably didn't start it till like 70, 71, 72, because once Gobind Khurana started talking about the fact that we could make nucleotides, all sorts of people came to us and asked us to make them.
Did that become the biggest part of the business?
No. Minor. Always minor, in spite of what you say in your write-up. Very minor. But to us, it was a way of supporting what we wanted to do on a bigger sense. So we made all the primers that Howard Temin used and David Baltimore for their work on reverse transcriptase. We made a big oligomer, a sixmer was big to us then, a sixmer for Hamilton Smith because he wanted to do the crystal structure of of a piece of DNA. And often they would go to write it into their grants. So then they got the grant money and their academic grant that then they could spend at Collaborative to get the materials made. We made the oligo DT cellulose, which was then used to isolate messenger RNA. So all the early mRNA work, you'll find it cites oligo DT cellulose from Collaborative research, if you read the publications. Mm-hmm. So they were all buying it from us. So once it became known that we could make some things, we would commercialize them. And that again was another, in the 70s, was another means of supporting the company.
Right.
Somewhere I think I have a box of some of the way old catalogs.
Oh, those would be, if we could get all those and digitize them.
Right. I'd have to rummage through some
boxes.
If
you do that, let us know.
Yeah, I will.
Ori Friedman had been at Brandeis. Did he leave the university after he started the company?
Yes, he was at Harvard, and then he moved to Brandeis. And he again, I believe he taught chemistry. I may be slightly wrong on that. But yeah, he left Brandeis to start the company. Mm-hmm. So again, that was another, you know, and I guess he could only do it because he was independently wealthy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so we, like many other companies, need to get myself a Kleenex. We did number of, so the first academic that I really remember working closely with as a sort of advisor was Dieter Zoll from Yale University. And he would help us again with the chemistry of a lot of the nucleotide work. And I don't remember the name of whoever it was who helped on the cell culture and the immunoassay work, but we did have some early advisors there. David Baltimore was, so I'm jumping now to sort of like the mid-70s.
Right.
Where we were very, you know, we had these three technologies all going well, all with support, and we had a research products division, and then recombinant DNA begins to come along, and restriction enzymes. We thought seriously about making restriction enzymes. The New England Biolabs sort of jumped the gun, so we didn't get into that piece of it. But recombinant DNA came along, and Ori immediately recognized that that could be used to make proteins, mm-hmm. his dream, mm-hmm. even though we were, I'll back up a tiny bit more. We had these cell lines that made growth hormone and neurokinase. We had an endless battle with the FDA over those because we were the first company to come in with, we've got cell lines. A cell line means the cells will grow forever. Mm-hmm. They're different than your normal cells. They are transformed. Mm-hmm. And the FDA was deeply concerned about using a transformed, altered cell to produce a human protein that was going to be given to people therapeutically. Mm-hmm. So they dragged us over the coals in terms of, and they just took, was so long, so slow, you know, just, it took forever. But we laid the groundwork for the FDA when recombinant technology came along, which is just a different means of getting the cell line, mm-hmm. but it's still a transformed cell line. But they accepted it all much more readily because of the 5 to 7 years we'd had of battles with the FDA to try and get approval of our cell lines for using them.
Do you remember the detail? How you're working in DNA chemistry? Is that where you are?
No, I by this time I was VP of R&D for the whole company.
Oh, okay. So you're overseeing.
Yeah, I oversaw everything.
Right.
Right.
So when this is going on, do you recall the details of conversations with the FDA? They wanted to see?
No. And I'll tell you why. It's because mainly Abbott and Organon had those conversations with them. We were considered researchers, and we would supply cell lines, materials, methods. They would then try and grow them in their own labs, and they handled all the FDA work. So all we knew was, so it was Organon and Abbott dealing with the FDA. I just remember that, you know, forever, the FDA hating the thought of using a transformed cell line.
And did they come to you and say, okay, this is where they've originated, tell us how you did it? And
the FDA didn't. It was all done. Organon came. We had to supply documentation and all sorts of stuff. And remember, we didn't do a lot of what you would do today in terms of characterization. The tools and technologies that we use today didn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, we were very rudimentary, I will fully admit. We were, mm-hmm. you know, it works, doesn't it, type of thing. So, I didn't. All I know is I just remember the constant. Every time we had a, we would have, you know, meetings every 2 or 3 months with our pharmaceutical company partners. You know, big day-long meetings, and we go through, you know, the data we had, the data they had, and how to deal with and what to put in. But they did all the face-to-face work with the FDA.
Well, on the one hand, that's a technical issue, you know, just, you know, making decisions about cells. But on the other hand, it's a commercial problem where there aren't a lot that injects a lot of uncertainty into the...
Right. But I don't think anyone else was going to the FDA at that time. This is the mid-70s, wanting, saying, I've got a cell line that makes growth hormone. You know, and in fact, it's interesting, when Genentech was the first one to get recombinant human growth hormone on the market, and they ran a clinical trial with only about 30 subjects. It was not thought to be enough data until Creutzfeldt-Jakob surfaced, and the FDA had to withdraw approval for the process using cadaver tissue and instantly approved Genentech's method. So even Genentech was having a slow time, I believe, initially with the FDA, until Creutzfeldt-Jakob surfaced and suddenly the FDA had no choice but to say, there's another method of making it. And, you know, we all I can tell is that the groundwork was being laid in those... In the 70s by a collaborative. I don't think anyone else had cell lines making human proteins at that time.
And you mentioned Dieter Saul was involved in, an advisor for DNA chemistry.
He was an advisor on the chemistry side. And by the way, we also had lots of projects with Bob Gallo at the NIH, we made all sorts of modified nucleotides with different linkages, groups blocked, and those eventually became the precursor for a lot of the AIDS drugs. A lot of the antivirals are modified nucleotides, nucleosides. Mm-hmm. But the original basic work, and we didn't patent anything on a lot of these because we didn't know a use. We were just making things that we could do. Mm-hmm. So recombinant DNA technology came along, and Ori realized we needed to do it, so that's when we first started working with David Baltimore. And obviously we had a long-term relationship with David because we'd been supplying him with materials, nucleotides for reverse transcriptase assays from the very early 70s. I think he got his Nobel Prize in some, like, the mid-70s,
75,
something like that. So, I mean, we'd been working with him for a long time. So I think it was like 1 or 2 years after that Ari brought him on as a sort of an advisor to the company as a whole with how do we get into recombinant DNA and what can we use it for and what can we do. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the very early science board, I believe Dieter Zoll was on it. Mm-hmm. He never became sort of formally, but I remember there were some informal groups of, it was Wally Gilbert, believe it or not, Wally Gilbert, David Baltimore, Dieter, and I'm pretty sure David Botstein was involved in some of those early conversations, but none of the others that you mentioned in your listing, because some of them, like Mark Skolnick, came 10 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, wait, this was in, as I say, the 70s. And I remember we had a lot of brainstorming meetings. I remember one on a Saturday morning, because the only time we could get everybody together with Wally and David and stuff, and we were sort of brainstorming how to use this technology, and we spent a lot of time focusing on hydrogenase. There was a big debate back then as to could these protein drugs ever really be therapeutics, the pharmaceutical industry. When you talk to pharmaceutical people, they were very negative. They were chemists. They didn't think that biologics could ever seriously be drugs. You couldn't make them, you couldn't characterize them. You know, there was variations. And the pharmaceutical...
Eli Lilly is giving insulin to people.
Right. So. We were not working with Eli Lilly.
Right, but example of a protein being used therapeutically.
But probably the only one, if you think about it. I think growth hormone and back in the...
Well, there were blood factors.
Nope, didn't exist. Well, so you should look up when factor VIII was first sort of used. To treat
people didn't understand it, but I mean, they were making concentrates, of right. blood factor concentrates.
Right, by from human blood.
Yeah.
Right, which probably were grossly impure, just sort of extracts. I know, we brainstormed a lot about therapeutics, but we also brainstormed a lot about non-therapeutics. And back then there was a big push on industrial enzymes were thought to be a target. And we brainstormed a lot hydrogenase, because we thought if we could clone the gene for hydrogenase and make hydrogen, you can convert water to hydrogen to have an energy source. So that's one of the things we worked on.
How far did that go?
Not far. But you know, the industrial enzymes did go somewhere. We got a big contract with the Dow Chemical Company. It's amazing. Dow was one of the very early supporters of recombinant technology. The other big supporter was Kirin Brewery, who supported a lot of the work out on the West Coast. And again, the
and collaborative too.
And collaborative, yep. I mean, so it was not the pharmaceutical industry back then who thought about this technology. And I can give you a few comments later on when I was at Biogen, because we had a lot of interaction with them. But so at collaborative, one of the targets Dow came up with was chymosin, which is the enzyme which is used to make cheese. And the enzyme, you have to get it from animals, you have to have veal, you have to have milk-fed calves that are under a few weeks of age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reasonable source in the sense that, I hate to say it, but every male calf is sent to the slaughterhouse pretty early on because they're not milk cows. I mean, so there is, but it's still not a big source. And so they wanted us to clone the gene for chymosin, which we actually did, and we filed the patents on it, and I think we filed the patents like 1980, 81, something like that. And I believe it was the first enzyme made by non-extracting technologies that was approved by the FDA. And it was eventually licensed by Dow to Pfizer, I believe, and Pfizer collected royalties on that. Collaborative got royalties on that for a long time. So we tend to seem to focus much more on, you know, non-therapeutic ones. And that, I think, is one of the reasons ultimately Collaborative didn't totally succeed as a company, mm-hmm. was because it didn't get into the therapeutic end.
And why not?
Well, you got to also, so I'll go back to that meeting I remember with Wally Gilbert on a Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted Wally to be on our, David wanted him to be on the science board, and he said no, and about a week later, Biogen was formed. So Biogen, I think, was 1978.
Yeah.
So, but what we did was we always think that we gave Wally the idea of, and he was very close with Charles Weissman in Switzerland,
yeah.
and they formed, it was Charles Weissman and Wally who really got Biogen going
right.
in 1978. So, and they picked, and one of the reasons they did a lot of the work in Switzerland, and while Biogen's first labs were all in Geneva, was because of all the ordinances that existed here. You couldn't do recombinant DNA
right.
work in labs. We were fighting.
Yeah, did you have a P3 lab or what?
We couldn't even do.
Where was Collaborative located?
Well, Collaborative was in Waltham.
Okay.
So we discovered, and we actually about this time moved to Lexington. So we actually had two labs,
uh-huh.
and we discovered that when Cambridge went through all its stuff, saying you have to have a, you know, license and or ordinance to manage recombinant DNA, we discovered that Waltham didn't have one. We were supposed to even have a lab permit, which we didn't have, and Lexington had one. So I actually had to go before all the city councils and get the ordinances written and through those towns. So that also slowed us because they were behind Cambridge. They sort of wanted to see what Cambridge did,
mm-hmm.
and then we got them in place in those two towns as well. So I think that's another reason why we were a little behind in terms of the Genentechs and then the other reason we were behind the Biogens and the Genentechs was that Collaborative, remember, was funded by contracts, company support. We were not VC funded. They've got a big slug of VC money. We never had VC money in
yeah.
Collaborative. The company grew. It was about 170, 180 people was the biggest it ever got, by the way. We went public in, I'm guessing, like 1980, 81. We were the second company to go public after Genentech. So what also happened around that time was there was so-called professional management put into the company to take it public. And the professional management consisted of some people out of the pharmaceutical industry, and Ari Freeman was actually pushed aside for a couple of years. He was not the CEO for a couple of years. He was chairman of the board, but he was sort of pushed out, and this professional management was put in. And the company was taken public, an IPO was done, and then about 2 years later we did a secondary offering. I mean, I did roadshows for that. But then Ari was able to step back in. The guy they brought in to be CEO came from Ethicon, which make medical devices, and he did not get the science of what we were doing, so I have to be careful what you say, by the way. He didn't get the science, and he just left, so Ari stepped back in. The problem we had was, even though we raised something like $35 million in the IPO, I don't remember quite the numbers, but something like that, Ari didn't want to spend the capital. As head of R&D, I was allowed to spend the interest we got from putting that money in the bank.
And how did you feel about that at the time?
Not good. And so that's another reason Collaborative wasn't competitive. Ari, sort of, like a lot of people who are at the forefront, he knew what he should be doing, but then he didn't have the sort of courage to fully invest and throw everything into it. Mm-hmm. And recombinant DNA technology overtook him. I mean, Collaborative got overtaken. And so back up a little bit. So having got it public, done a secondary offering, Ari back in there, we had, by this point, Ron Davis and David Botstein on the scientific advisory board. Mm-hmm. They took sabbaticals and came and worked in the company for a year. Mm-hmm. And between you and me, it was awful.
It was awful. Didn't they bring? The other scientists at the company were not.
Their way of doing research was an academic way, which would go this way, we go this way, we go this way, we go this way.
Yeah.
All over the place. We were just dragged right, left, and center, and very unproductive.
And this, at this time, you're the vice president
of R&D,
and so. Yeah.
It was tough. And I'll tell you another little story. So Helen Donis-Keller, who you put as being recruited, she had to leave Biogen. She came to Collaborative because she was David Botstein's girlfriend. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that was also another issue that was going on in all this time period. Mm-hmm. So we had a year of them in the lab, and it was not only unproductive, it was very difficult for the people. The company made a big focus on yeast as a vehicle for recombinant yeast to produce instead of CHO cells. That was another reason, and mainly that was because Ron Davis, Jerry Fink, and David Botstein did work in yeast in their own labs, academic labs. So Collaborative picked yeast as the vector for making proteins, and it was the wrong choice. CHO cells have been. And the reason they thought yeast was because yeast does put sugars onto its molecules, but so do CHO cells. But you also got to remember back then, most of the work, like the early insulin, was produced in E. coli, which doesn't put sugars on. So it was seen as being a limit. You know, E. coli was limited. And our advisors, this scientific advisory board, said we need to do yeast. So we did yeast. The problem is yeast is too complex, too difficult to manage. Kirin Brewery uses it to make beer, which is another reason why it's thought of as being, it's a commercially grown cell. People know how to grow yeast. Mm-hmm. They do, but not under the conditions to make therapeutics. Great for making beer, but not for making therapeutics.
Mm-hmm. And yeast more complex than CHO cells?
Oh yeah, way more. Yeast, you know, CHO cells were thought of as being a problem because they like to grow on a surface. CHO cells don't, whereas yeast will grow in suspension, but people solve the problem of E. coli wanting a surface by growing them on beads. So people have pseudo suspension cultures by having little microscopic beads that float around, and the CHO cells grow on that. So
CHO cells, not E. coli.
Right, not E. coli is easy to grow, but you can't make many proteins in that. So the workhorse of the industry, Collaborative, did not pick it, picked a focus on yeast, picked a focus on industrial enzymes, and then eventually that turned into a focus on sequencing bacterial genomes, genome therapeutics. So it just, it sort of made the wrong bets. And that's that. So in the 80s, it made the wrong bets, the wrong direction to go in. It did publish the first linkage map.
And that was Botstein and was, Bob Dinan and
Don Scala. Botstein, and that's when Mark Skolnick came on, and Ray White. They came on to do that specific sort of project. They were never actually really officially on the scientific advisory board, I don't believe. And I don't even know when that sort of fell apart and sort of, because I'd left the company by then. I left in 1983. Wally Gilbert, who I knew well from 5 years of, 4 or 5 years of, he recruited me to go to Biogen. So it's like Biogen swapped. Helen and I overlapped, but only for about a year. So she came to Collaborative and I went to Biogen, and I was Biogen's first VP of Business Development. So Wally originally wanted me to go to Geneva to help Julian Davis with running the Geneva operations, because that was by far the biggest piece of the company back then, but I didn't want to move to a foreign country and all of that, and I had kids. So he created the job of VP of Business Development at Biogen, and that's where I moved in 1983.
Okay, before we talk about Biogen, I just have a few questions about going back pre-rDNA days. You're working with mammalian cells to grow proteins. Who were the biology advisors at that time?
And you know, I racked my brains, but I don't recall any big names, because I don't think even people in academia were doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how foresighted Ori was at that point in time.
And he was a biochemist.
He was a chemist. His degrees were chemistry, like mine. But I mean, remember, I only did chemistry for like the first couple of years. You very quickly, once you realize you can make DNA, you get interested in what can you do with it.
Yes.
And you get into cell biology, molecular biology. Mm-hmm. You know, we were isolating messenger RNAs, tRNAs. We were no longer, and that's also why even the chemical synthesis of DNA switched to the triester method, and Collaborative didn't even keep up with that. In the 80s, Marvin Carruthers developed the triester method.
Yeah.
We were using the diester, and that, so, you know, Collaborative is a great study as well for sort of
making
doing it right.
Yeah.
And
what was making oligonucleotides still part of the business?
Or? Yes, but once the diester method came in somewhere in the 1980s, Collaborative really lost that business.
Mm-hmm.
And it still had the business model of getting a lot of grants and contracts with the government, but a big part of their business, they had a big, I can't remember who supported the work to sequence the bacterial, I'd have to do some thinking about, but they got another big contract with a pharmaceutical company to synthesize a lot of bacteria, to sequence a lot of the genomes of bacteria.
And what methods are being used to sequence?
We were using Sanger, whatever was the standard method. I mean, sequencing back in the mid 70s when Wally Gilbert and company first developed it. We were doing sequencing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And do you happen to know what were the first projects that Ori Freeman started with when he...
Before you arrived.
Yeah.
Because all I can tell you is when I arrived, we were working on growth hormone, urokinase, immunoassays, and Gobin-Karanda's project.
So there were those three. Which was the biggest?
I actually think the cell culture was probably the biggest.
Okay.
But I may be wrong on that. I mean, there are only, as I said, 30 or 40 people.
Yeah.
There was a guy who headed up, who was sort of head of biology, and there was a guy who was the VP of chemistry, who I reported to, and within a year of me joining, he left, and I didn't get the title for a long time, but I took over, ran the whole, and then when the company came to sort of restructure to go public, that's when I was made VP of R&D for the whole company, with it all reporting into me officially. At one point, there were like three VPs with different pieces of it, and then I was put above all of it. So I mean, you're asking me 30 years ago?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I was just asking you.
I know.
And during this, I had another question. What's your perception on, if you want to find out about Genentech or Biogen, you know, the reams of stuff out there.
Right.
But collaborative research is...
I know.
Because
largely by the early 80s, it was being eclipsed.
Yeah.
When I joined Biogen, I left a company that was around probably 150 people for one that was 200 plus. 24 or 25 were in Cambridge, more were in Geneva, but that the Cambridge just grew. I mean, it was hundreds of people in Genentech by that point. So one of the reasons I left, because I realized, you know, collaborative was, that the peak of collaborative was probably, you know, 78, 79, 80, 81.
Yeah.
And because it didn't invest in the right technologies, it didn't spend its capital the way it should have done, it couldn't keep up. Mm-hmm. And the world went way beyond it.
Right. And you were pretty high in the organization, right?
I was the VP of R&D.
Right. You're involved in conversations about...
Remember, I had 2 years with this other CEO who didn't grasp the business. And there was a sales guy brought in from Lilly. The CFO came from Texas Instruments. So I had a management team where I was the only internal sort of person. There's all this professional management brought in who messed up the company. And I moved on.
Yeah. And did you have conversations? You were there for a number of years and close to Ari Fried?
Oh, I was very close to Ari. I was there for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I worked with Ari for... Bar the 2 years where this other guy was in there, I worked there with Ari the entire time.
Yeah, was it hard to leave, to talk to him?
The main reason I left was because, as I said, the company to me was going downhill. And, you know, you got to remember, we got a very powerful scientific advisory board between those four people, mm-hmm. very opinionated, and they felt that yeast was the way to go. And
did you at that time? Did you think no, or did you? Were you agnostic? Or
I was a little agnostic. I mean, I just would. I knew lots of people at Genentech, and I even knew people at Amgen. George Rathman tried to get me to go out to join Amgen. I knew people at all these other companies, and I'm going, there's more fun over there than here. And I was. There's no way I could counter scientific advisory board. No way. And their big thing was to do this, you know, this RIFOP map, the linkage map, and use yeast, because that was the skills and what they did in their academic labs.
Well, the linkage map is a nice piece of academic.
Right. Exactly. It was, and by the way, when it got published, while most of the work was done at Collaborative, it was published as though it was MIT and everybody else. Mm-hmm. So I mean, Collaborative didn't even get that. Those, you know, Collaborative. It's a classic business case of having the right vision, but letting the and setting the stage for everybody else. Mm-hmm. Think of all the ways it set the stage, even the how it's financed, the business model, starting research products, working with companies, going public. The only thing it never had was VCs. If it had VCs in, you know, the VCs would have made it go in the right direction, but it didn't have that. Mm-hmm. One of the people on the board of directors came from the computer industry, from DEC. So it didn't have the right pieces there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when Wally wanted me to move, I moved.
Yeah. Do you happen to know did Ari Fried ever write anything about the company or the strategy or his thoughts about therapeutic proteins or his thoughts about this emerging industry?
I don't think so. Not
yeah,
that
that's
I know
awful.
Of. Which is why I would have loved you to have been able to talk to him.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I knew him for years afterwards, because he and I were both on the board of the Worcester Foundation, which a lot of his philanthropy went there. So, I mean, I was on that till about 10 years ago. So I last saw him probably about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, no, I mean, it's a shame, because there's also, there's one person I do know and I have contact with still from these early days, Jerry Vovis, V-O-V-I-S.
V-O-V-I-S.
And I can get you his, I've got his mailing address, yeah. And I can get you that.
That'd be great.
But I know the names, but I have no idea where any of that early group are. And Jerry only came in when we started the recombinant work, so like 1975, 76, I believe.
Do you know the names of any people who were there very early and saw the whole thing develop from in the 60s? And then maybe we could try to track them down if you know the names. Who was there when you arrived?
Nicholas Starkovsky, but I'm certain he's dead by now.
Uh-huh.
He was the VP of chemistry.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you got to remember, I was 24 when I joined.
Yeah, yeah.
They were all in their 30s and 40s.
Yes.
I mean, they'd be in their late 80s now.
Yeah, that's why we're writing the history. It's time to write it.
I mean,
yeah.
I go, no. And if you talk to any of, like, you know, David Baltimore, Jerry Fink, Ron Davis, they'll give you from the late 70s, from when recombinant DNA happened, because that's when they first got involved.
Mm-hmm.
That first 20 years is hard to place.
Mm-hmm.
And even people like Jerry only came when recombinant DNA technology sort of evolved.
Yeah.
I mean, Dieter Zoll must be... I mean, he was 10 to 20 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 68. He's 78. 88. They're in their 80s.
Yeah.
And I mean, even the ordinary technicians and people I worked with were way older than me.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason I didn't get the title of VP of R&D, even though I was doing the job.
Yeah. You were the youngest person.
I was the youngest person in the company.
Mm-hmm.
So you know,
Was there any resistance when you did get the title, or resistance
well,
the
only reason I finally got the VP piece, there was no resistance to me running all the R&D, but I only got, because they had to put it in the prospectus for going public.
Mm-hmm.
The underwriters went, we need a VP of R&D. Who's doing it?
Was that something that bothered you at the time? Or
of
you're
course.
Saying, yes, okay.
And why do you think I didn't get, because I'm a woman.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a different era.
And I can tell you the CEO they brought in couldn't stand having a woman as head of R&D. This must not go in your stuff, but his view was he wanted someone who was available 24/7. And I had four kids. And I said, I'm available 24/7, but I just need 24 hours notice to get childcare. He couldn't stand that. So this was a very sexist environment. I was probably one of the only few women, and I was the only woman at any level in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking a whole different generation and environment.
Although some women are still in biotech, it's very much in minority still.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's changing. But,
oh, yeah. At the top, you'll find, like, Genzyme, where I worked for a long time, it's like 55% women, but the minute you get above the bottom, you're a minority by a long way.
Yeah.
Single person. Mm-hmm. You're the only woman. So yeah. I mean, did Ari write anything? I mean, if you do a Google search, you might still come up. Because often people, when they're referenced, they will.
Yeah, no, we'll have to look. I don't know that we've actually really done an exhaustive search. And then maybe we could also
And maybe try Dieter Zoll, because he was there like in the 1970-ish,
mm-hmm.
and he was never officially on the science board, so, you know, he was not considered, he didn't do recombinant DNA stuff, and he wasn't considered in the same league as the MIT people of this world.
Yeah.
Didn't have a Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but, you know, I just... The guy who was sort of my counterpart on the biology side, his name was Paul Kelly, but that's about all I could tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty common name, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And he was older than me, so I mean...
Yeah. Well, what you said is very helpful. We know a lot more now. It's very enlightening. We know more now than we did yesterday.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That's good.
So I can tell you the tiny bit about the early days of Biogen.
Yeah, no, but tell if you want.
So I was the first VP of business development. However, Wally's view of business development back then was, it was go and find some things that might be useful that we could work on in academia and bring them into the company. Business development today is thought of, this is what we've got, go and sell it. Mm-hmm. I was a buyer. So my job was to find things that were interesting for Biogen.
Did you like that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I mean, Biogen back then had tons of money from going public, I helped raise one of the first R&D partnerships with them. We and I still remember the comment.
What was
that
with?
With Biogen.
Yeah.
First R&D partnership.
Yeah.
Probably Payne Webber, but I can't be absolutely sure. I literally arrived and went on the road to sell the R&D partnership.
What was the project?
And I'd have to really stretch my memory. I couldn't even tell you. So it would have been in whatever R&D partnership they did in 1983. Mm. But I still remember a conversation with one of the scientists there, because they just spent money like it was, you know, money was just spent. And I remember a comment with one of the sort of scientists, what do we do if we run out of money? Oh, we'll just go and raise more on Wall Street. I mean, to me, it was a totally different attitude than collaborative, where we counted every penny. Every penny. Mm-hmm. Biogen splashed money right, left, and center. And it was, we'll just raise more. Yeah. So they were spending money galore. They also had, alpha interferon had been cloned, and we were reducing it for whoever was the commercial partner of that one. Whoever commercialized alpha interferon.
Yeah, was it Schering? I forget.
Schering.
Yeah.
Schering. So, and it was interesting. So we talked a lot with pharmaceutical companies. Even by then, and this is a comment actually made by the Dow Chemical Company back at Collaborative. When they agreed to the project on chymosin and funding it, they wanted to do it not because they necessarily thought chymosin would be commercially successful, but they wanted a window on the technology in case it became important. Mm-hmm. So all these pharmaceutical companies in that window, their view was, we just want to keep tabs on what you biotech companies are doing. We don't think you'll ever succeed, okay? Which is why a lot of the companies got left with the rights to, in fact, commercialize, because these companies never thought that you could ever manufacture on a large scale, get an FDA approval, get these on the market, and actually make drugs. Mm-hmm. They still didn't believe it, even by the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. So companies were able to get support because they wanted a window on the technology. So that was just a whole different... Biogen, to me, was a very different attitude, because they splashed money right, left, and center. They had, you know, Charles Weissman dominated the company with Wally Gilbert. Wally Gilbert was actually the CEO
at
that time. Wally is like a computer. He smiles, doesn't say much, but he takes it all in. And after every meeting, he would often race into my office and want to talk about the business side of the science, because he wasn't a business person, he was a scientist. I'd worked in this industry for 14 or 15 years by that point, and I was the only one who sort of had business experience, because I'd done, you know, all the
world
shows.
There's nobody else in the company?
No, Mark Skoletsky, who was there at the time, came from sales at Bristol Myers Squibb, which was not a sort of therapeutic company. Mm. It's a device company, much more. They make syringes and needles and things like that.
From a division of, or he, that he was from, Bristol
no,
at that
di-
time?
He came from a division of. Virtually everybody came from a division of. Mm-hmm. So I was the only one who'd really worked in the biotech industry. Mm-hmm. So Wally would come in and want to, you know, just brainstorm and talk about how do we make this, you know, how do we commercialize. And how do we, what does the science mean, where does it mean we go? And it was fortuitous luck that Genentech kept the rights to some of its products. Biogen didn't, by the way, they licensed those out, so Schering had the rights to alpha interferon. And again, this mustn't go out in your public stuff, but we can correct it later. But one of the main reasons was because Mark Skoletsky also thought, you can't commercialize these things. You know, small biotechs can't commercialize. They'll never be able to do it themselves. They don't have the big sales forces. So the view then, even by a lot of the people in the biotech industry, was, we can't sell these because you need a 10,000-person sales force. Genentech licensed out insulin, because Lilly basically demanded that. But their next products, they kept initially, mm-hmm. some they licensed out, but they bought back the marketing rights because they gradually realized, like with growth hormone, you don't need a big sales force. You can actually, and then the pricing was different. They don't cost $10 to make a pill, as it costs Big Pharma. It costs thousands of dollars. You need a different structure. So Genentech was the one that pioneered and set the stage for, we can actually put in a specialized marketing and sales force and sell these things. Mm-hmm. So that changed, and they were able to go and buy back a lot of their rights. They'd sold some, but they bought a lot of them back. And people don't realize that they actually did that buying back in those early days. Biogen didn't, because it had people who thought, we need a big sales force, we can't do it. So that's also why Biogen, very interesting, at some point in, I'm guessing, probably late 80s, Biogen and Genentech had the same profit line on the bottom. Bottom line was the same, but their market caps were totally different, because Biogen's was all royalties. They were getting a royalty stream. Genentech was actually getting sales because they sold products and had royalties. So they both companies had the same bottom line, but their market values were like this, Genentech way higher. And that's when Biogen realized you get more money, if you get more valuation on your stock price if you actually control the top line and the bottom line. You, in other words, sell your own drugs. But it took Biogen another 20 years to develop Avonex, beta interferon, and then its multiple sclerosis. So Biogen lagged because it also did a slightly the wrong business strategy around marketing your own drugs.
But with that strategy, I mean, there really were only a handful of companies that actually succeeded at it.
Yes. So Genentech succeeded, but again, if you think of Genzyme succeeded because it got a small molecule, it got a drug for a small market, but it set the stage. And now Big Pharma's doing small molecule, small market drugs.
Right.
So I mean, isn't everything's topsy turvy with what's gone on in?
Right.
And the other thing that changed was the companies like Genentech, Amgen, Genzyme set the stage for a whole different pricing strategy. I mean, I still remember a very early conversation with Henry Tamir when we were getting, back then it was Seradaze, the placental product, we were getting it approved and how we were going to price it. And we did a lot of calculations and we knew what it cost us to make. We were only making it on a relatively small scale. And I remember when we worked out what it would cost us, it was like $200,000 or $300,000 per patient. It's about 75. We launched at 300. It was actually costing us $600,000 per patient per year to make it at that point in time. We launched it at 300, and I remember going, and I remember Henry just looking at me going, you know, we have to. I mean, he had steel nerves to go and do that, to launch at that price. And we launched, it was costing us twice what we were selling it at, and it took us 6 months to go up the growth curve of scaling up and getting to a bigger scale and recruiting patients, where we kept the same price, but we brought our manufacturing costs down. And it took about, so for 6 months we lost money, and then after 6 months we broke even, and then eventually got the costs below so that it was then profitable.
Did that make sense to you? Were you confident that they would go in that direction?
Yes. Yes. I mean, when you sit down, but I as a scientist, because remember, I'm still basically a scientist, would not think it through in the same way that Henry thought it through. Henry was, again, another visionary in this whole industry. And he clearly saw what you had to do to make it a commercial success. So he was another fabulous instincts on what to do. So, I mean, Seradaze, I believe, is still the world's most expensive drug. It always was.
It's one of them. Been superseded by a couple of others.
But you know, even Genentech and Amgen didn't launch their products at those sorts of prices. We were stuck with the fact that, I mean, we didn't even know if there were enough patients, by the way, and we got the patient numbers completely wrong.
It's really about 5,000, right?
We did the R&D partnership to support Ceridays. We thought there were 10,000 people in the U.S. and we thought the product we priced at $75,000. So we had a $750 million market. There's only about 1,200 patients in the U.S. There's about 5,000 worldwide, but there's only about 1,200 to 1,500 in the U.S., and that's also why the price had to go up. We couldn't be anything close to what was in the R&D partnership, because by then we knew a lot. We knew there were very few patients. Yeah. We only knew of 50 patients when we launched the drug. Mm-hmm. Only knew the names of 50 people in the whole world with that disease.
Yeah. No, it's a little crazy when you think about it. Pharmaceuticals being developed on that basis. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you think about it, if you only know fit, you do realize you don't need 10,000 salespeople.
Right. What was Mark Spilesky's role at Biogen?
He was chief operating officer under Wally Gilbert.
Mm-hmm. So, well, that's interesting. How did that work? Wally is by title CEO.
Right.
But he was. That was maybe his unique way of...
Remember, Wally was an academic scientist.
Well, he was criticized, right?
Yes,
running the place.
Yes,
as
he was. Yeah. So, and Mark was not a scientist. Mark was a commercial business person. So I worked very closely with him on bringing technologies and projects into the company. Wally had to sign off on the science. Mark had to sign off on the business sort of side of it. Mark was there for a long time. He did a great job, but you know, again, the thing that he missed was that you could commercialize that biotechs could actually sell these things. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until Genentech and Amgen really got going doing that Biogen started changing how it did its programs and keeping rights.
Well, I think maybe Biogen is one of the few companies that might be rightly criticized for doing it. I'm sure there are lots of companies where that wouldn't apply.
Yes. But when I joined Biogen, the big race was with Genentech and GI to clone genes to file the patents on the proteins. The big race was just clone it, get the patent. That's all those three companies were doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. And the group here in Cambridge was small?
It was initially, they had the building, but it was small. But I mean, I can't tell you the full numbers because I just don't remember the full numbers. But yes, there was much more. All the cloning work was being done in Europe. They were beginning to build a small manufacturing plant here, fermenting cells, CHO cells. So the original building that Biogen, I believe, is still in. I don't know if they're still in that
building.
They built lots.
But they still have the original.
Yeah. And Jim Vincent, I think, didn't Jim Vincent follow Wally as CEO? See, and he came out of Abbott.
Yeah, I think Abbott.
Came out of Abbott. Yeah. I mean, I left Biogen by then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, tell me about that. What were your perceptions about what was going on at Biogen? I mean, you've got world-class scientists.
As I said, the race was cloning genes just to control the rights to.
Yeah.
And Biogen, by the way, was losing, time-wise, was losing most of those battles to GI, which was getting all the blood factors, and to Genentech, which was getting a lot of the enzymes. Mm-hmm. So Biogen was the big challenge. They were always just behind. There was the racing, and then finally you're just being beaten.
There's Wally Gilbert, Charles Weissman, Phil Sharp,
Danny Wang,
Kenneth Murray. Well, how are they
Ken
losing?
Ken Murray, I remember being later. Because the work was, Charles, because you had to actually clone the genes in your own lab to not have MIT have rights, for example. You had to do the work yourself. They just were behind on either picking them or not picking, and back then you got to remember today we clone genes easily. Back then we didn't have half the technologies we have. I remember much more, every company used different vectors, different viral vectors or different plasmids for getting the gene into the cell. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were just random. And you then had to screen to try and find a clone that produced enough and that produced the full protein in the full amount. So it was we had Stone Age tools back then. That's also why some of these races didn't work.
And you're at Biogen for a little over a year?
A little over a year, and then I left. I left because the travels, I went to Geneva.
Oh.
Like every, I mean, as I said, they wanted me to be based in Geneva. I didn't want that. But then I had to go to Geneva like every 3 or 4 weeks. And I'd go for 5 days because you don't go there.
Sure.
So, I mean, the travel schedule was just awful for me as a woman with children, young children. At that time.
Yeah.
So so I left and I went to work for Damon Biotech.
Yeah, tell me about Damon Biotech. That's another one that we don't know anything about.
Because Nigel Webb was the CEO, and he's still around somewhere because he was a similar age to me, but I don't think he works in biotech anymore.
Was he a science guy or?
No. He came out of some pharmaceutical industry. But Marsha Feinlieb, you know Feinlieb, they do IRPR, and I'm blanking out her name, but Marsha, whatever her last name was, she worked for Damon, but she was their sort of corporate communications person. She was there when I arrived there, and she is still around, and I can get you her contact information.
Okay.
She could tell you a lot about Damon
and
about Damon Biotech.
What did you know about the company when...
Well, when I joined them, I actually joined to head up a subsidiary company they'd formed called Vivotech, which was a joint venture between Damon and Connaught Labs to try and develop encapsulated islet cells that would you could then use to treat diabetic people. You'd implant them in their peritoneal cavity, and they would glucose would go in, insulin would come out. The cells would there would be pancreatic cells, pancreatic islet cells.
How did that work?
The technology worked well, except that the relatively short time frame because the alginate capsules became overgrown. Your body responds to something that seems foreign by coating it with cells. And you overgrow it, and it blocks the pores up, so they don't work.
It's immunogenic.
It's an. It's not immunogenic. Alginate is not does algin.
Yeah, okay. But it's.
But it gets overgrown. Your body is responding more to probably growth factors and other things that the cells make. They don't just make insulin.
Mm.
There's nutrients going in, waste products going out, and your body's probably responding to some of those, and it coats and encloses and blocks the pores up on those. So Patrick Soon-Shiong, who's another big name, worked with us back then. And of course now he's
in the company or at...
No, he was one of the consultants we worked with on trying to isolate pancreatic islet cells because we had two challenges. You had to get the right pancreatic islet cells and you had to make the capsules. So the islet cells were coming from Connaught Labs, the capsules from Damon. Neither wanted to license each other, so they formed a joint venture. Both put money in, both put technology in. Damon's big mistake was that they set it up for a 2-year stint and then it was a reevaluation. If one company didn't put money in, the other company could take the technology and use it. Damon ran out of money, couldn't put money in.
Lost the technology.
Connaught took it all over. Mm. Connaught wanted me to move to Toronto. I didn't want to go to Toronto any more than I wanted to go to Switzerland. So I, after 2 years, left. I mean, I had no choice. The company moved to Toronto.
Where was the company located?
Here in, we had offices and labs in Needham, in Damon's facilities. Marsha Keene, K-E-E-N-E, M-A-R-C-I-A, and it's Feinstein Keene Partners. So she's the Keene part of that. But she's still around and she can tell you all about Damon.
Okay.
Because she was there before. And she was there after I left as well.
Yeah.
So,
do you remember hearing the story of the origins, how it got started, where the original technology came from, or
of where the encapsulation technology
was
came
it?
From?
Was it? Was that the main thing?
That was what Damon had. I mean, Damon made instruments for diagnostics, but they had the technology for encapsulation, the alginate capsules. That's
and
what the piece.
Where did
they
that
had.
Originate?
Did,
So they were already there doing diagnostic stuff, instrumentation?
Yes, instruments. It was a big company. Big company.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it was called Damon Biotech?
It was called Damon. Damon Corporation. They formed a subsidiary, Damon Biotech, use this encapsulation technology, because again, it was thought of, you could encapsulate CHO cells, so grow them in culture. So instead of, you know, I said most people grow them on the outside of beads, mm-hmm. this was have alginate capsules that you can grow them inside of.
Yeah. The capsules are permeable.
Yes. Yeah. And Abbott had a big, so Abbott Bioscience, which was eventually formed out in Worcester, eventually bought that technology away from Damon Biotech, and all that encapsulation technology became the starting point for Abbott Biotech out in Worcester. And Damon stopped doing any of that. And then, as I say, the VivaTech piece. So Damon Corporation formed Damon Biotech to develop the biotech applications of this encapsulation technology. VivaTech was formed because they wouldn't license Connaught. Connaught had all the insulin technology. And so we got to, VivaTech was formed from both those pieces. Mm-hmm. Then Connaught took over all the insulin piece of it. And it kept going for a long time. I mean, it's never been fully commercialized, but Patrick Soon-Shiong took over a lot of that and then eventually formed, I'm blanking out the company, but he's one of these billionaires because he still owns a huge piece of the company he founded. Hmm. So he should be in your database somewhere as well. But so I was there for 2 years. Then I went to ADL, which was...
What was your role there specifically?
I was general manager. So I didn't get the title CEO. I was running a company, but I was called general manager. Okay? You...
Yeah, okay.
Life mm-hmm. takes a long time to change.
Yes. And that was an annoyance to you?
Absolutely. But that was my title. Mm-hmm. So I went to ADL in like 1986, 87, that window. And ADL wanted me to come desperately because by now pharma had realized biotech was useful, it was great for research, you could make products. They needed this business, and they all wanted to get into biotech. They were going to ADL saying, how do we do this? What do we do? So ADL hired me to go into all these big pharma companies and help them set up biotech, help them restructure how they did their R&D. So I worked with Boehringer Ingelheim in Germany. I worked with J&J. Ortho Biotech came out of all of that. So I mean, I worked for a year for ADL. I loved the business. The travel was horrible because as a consultant, again, you go places. Mm-hmm. So when Henry Tamir approached me in like the middle of 1987 and said, would I come to Genzyme? I came.
Doing the consultant work, did you find resistance? I mean, you're going into organizations.
Oh, no. They were desperate to get into biotech by this point. I mean, the big pharma had woken up. They no longer wanted a window. They wanted to get in and get in as fast as possible.
And were they able to do it? I mean, how effective do you think you were in, or how effective were they?
For the time period that I was there, it was just the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, it's taken them... Every big pharma now has huge biotech skills. They're equal. And I actually talk about the Amgens, the Genentechs, the Genzymes. To me, they are biopharmaceutical companies. I mean, Henry doesn't like this, but once Genzyme got to be, you know, 5,000-10,000 people, he watched the sales. It no longer became an R&D driven company. It's a sales driven company. Because it's so important to get the sales, to get the profits, to fund the research. So companies change, and when they become focused on sales and manufacturing and the margins, R&D becomes secondary, and they're no longer as innovative. I mean, Henry doesn't like me to say it, but Genzyme is not innovative. Genzyme has developed very few of its products itself. They buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're competing with pharma to buy projects. And to buy them when they're now in the clinic, not, you know, before it was you bought them when you got the gene cloned and you got the cell line. Mm-hmm. So I call them biopharmaceutical companies. Biotech to me is the small entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. developing new technologies. because the new technologies don't come out of these big biotechs anymore.
Right.
And they don't like me saying that, but I do.
No. It's not a secret that big organizations are not good at doing
it. But when I joined Genzyme, they had two big businesses. They bought the old Koch Light pharmaceutical intermediate business in Britain, and from Wattman Reeve Angel, they bought a business where you could make enzymes.
So they still had that by
they were bought. Yes, that was the. And Henry wanted to build a therapeutics business. They had a contract with the NIH to make the enzyme glucocerebrosidase by trotting across the road to Tufts Medical Center and bringing black placental tissue, chopping them up in the lab, and extracting the enzyme. So another game, you know, the old method was extract from a tissue. That was and Roscoe Brady at the NIH, he was the one who originated that contract that Genzyme got. Henry Blair was at Tufts.
Henry Blair is also somebody I need to get
to. He's around.
Is he?
Yes. Okay. And I am go to Dyax because he's the founder of Dyax.
Yeah.
And he's, I'm certainly, he's still on their board. He was the CEO for a long time. If you just look up Dyax, you'll get in contact with him. But he had this project with Roscoe Brady, and when it, you know, it was more than Tufts could handle, so it was put into Genzyme to actually make the crude enzyme. We shipped a bulk crude enzyme down to the NIH.
So Henry Blair was at Tufts, and he had a contract?
Genzyme had a contract with the NIH to make the enzyme, but Henry Blair was very instrumental in making that happen, because Henry Blair at Tufts was the first one who worked with Roscoe Brady, chopping placenta.
Yeah.
And sending minuscule amounts back, when Roscoe realized and said, "I need to run some trials. I need more."
Yeah,
and then the contract was put into Genzyme so that Genzyme could make more. I mean, academic labs, and we also had to make it under conditions that were a little more controlled. You were worried about viruses, and back then, by the way, people think of HIV as the one you worry about, but it's actually hepatitis is the one that you have to worry about when you're getting placental tissue. Hepatitis is the big challenge that you have, as well as HIV. But so we had to develop all the techniques for inactivating viruses to get rid of them from the placental
And hepatitis
tissue.
Is harder than HIV.
Yes, HIV, it's simple. Just treat with alcohol, it's gone. A little swab with alcohol, it's gone. But hepatitis is much more difficult. We developed multiple treatments, columns. And you had to be careful you didn't denature the enzyme. We worked with the New York Blood Group. What was their name? New York. It's not the Red Cross, but they were sort of the Red Cross in New York, because they were also developing techniques to remove viruses from the blood supply. So we used a lot of the techniques that they developed and scaled them up. And then went to Lyon, to Pasteur Mérieux, where they, in France, back then, France, this is interesting. In France, back in the 70s and 80s, it was illegal to get a blood donation from a human being. You had to use it as a donated blood. You couldn't use leftover blood donations and extract blood coagulation factors out of them, so factor VIII, for example. So they were using collecting placental tissue, which is basically just a bag of blood, squeezing it, getting the blood out of that, throwing the tissue away, and then using the blood to make blood factors. That's why there's so many hemophiliacs in France who have AIDS, because they were not doing any treatment of it, they were just taking placental tissue. And so you've had a huge number of people in France, virtually all the hemophiliacs got AIDS. So they were throwing the tissue away. We wanted the tissue, because that's where the enzyme was. It wasn't in the blood, it was in the tissue. So it was a great partnership. We actually set up our own facilities in Lyon, in France, in a vacant building next to where they were doing the blood work, and did all our initial, you know, chopping and extraction, and sent a sort of crude frozen extract over that we then did all the purification of in Binney Street here in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm. And so the transportation cost, I mean, this is a massive thing, right? You need how many placentas?
Millions. In fact, the irony was the placenta were being collected in the U.S. shipped to Lyon, France, because they collected tissue from all over the world to get enough for their factor VIII supply.
So this is why it cost $700,000 to...
It's one of the reasons, yes. I mean, Cerezyme is a lot cheaper. It's very, very profitable. Don't say that.
Okay.
But it is very
profitable. And it could be priced.
But they kept
because
the price
of Sarah Day,
they just kept the same price. Never changed price.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's good. They have plenty of revenues to work with to develop new.
To buy new
well,
products.
Well, that's as it turns out. But
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were, and there you were, senior vice president.
Senior VP of biotherapeutics.
Yeah, and so then your role was that you were overseeing this entire project?
Yes. Jim Rasmussen was the VP of R&D, so he directed the scientists in the lab. As I said, Henry wanted to build a biotherapeutics business, so that was my mandate. One of the technologies was this... the enzyme, which became Cerezyme. They also had a technology for making hyaluronic acid and modifying hyaluronic acid. So we eventually did a big R&D partnership and funded that, and that turned into the Seprafilm, the Sepra, all the hyaluronic acid products, the surgical aids. what other thing was going on? Those are the two big things in that early stage, were the hyaluronic acid and the... And then we bought Integrated Genetics. Once we got Cerezyme, the placental product, once we knew it worked, and by the way, we knew within months of starting the trial, because every patient responds beautifully. I mean, it's a drug that really, really works in children who've got a really devastating disease. So, I mean, it's worth the money. I have no problem with the money because it changes people's lives. But once we realized Cerezyme worked, we knew Genzyme did not have recombinant DNA skills. They were very minor. So that's why Integrated Genetics was bought in, I believe, something like 1989, because we needed their recombinant skills. So that brought a whole bunch more recombinant projects in. So the thyrogen came from Integrated Genetics. And by the way, when Integrated Genetics did their due diligence on Genzyme to see whether they wanted to be bought, I know... because Alan Smith told me this, and Bob Carpenter, he said they never thought Cerezyme would ever be a success.
Cerezyme,
because Cerezyme, remember, didn't even...
But they
that's ridiculous. There's not enough patients. They'll never get money out of that. And the price, they went, $300,000? You know, but of course...
Well, it was a new model, so yeah, that's right. But
and by the way, they were also involved in those very early days of racing to clone genes, and they lost the battle everywhere. I mean, that's why they ended up being acquired. But they had really good scientists, so we moved the recombinant program, which had been ongoing all the time while Cerezyme was being done, but it wasn't
the idea,
done...
Was it Cerezyme, the idea to make a recombinant version of Cerezyme?
We thought that if Cerezyme worked, we knew we would have to switch to a recombinant form, but we didn't really invest much money in it until we knew Cerezyme's clinical results, and that's when Henry then started trying to buy Integrated Genetics, because we knew we needed more skills than we had. So the Integrated Genetics people are the ones who really developed Cerezyme from the manufacturing sense. They have the technology. Genzyme uses technology growing on beads, and they actually developed the technology at Integrated Genetics for growing things on CHO cells on beads. So they had all the CHO cell technology that Genzyme needed. So that was a good marriage on the technology side, and then of course they were wrong. Cerezyme was a success, and of course if Cerezyme wasn't a success, Cerezyme wouldn't have been either. But
right.
And then thyrogen we also got through. So.
So you were looking around with Integrated Genetics is there, and that turned out to be a good fit. But
yes.
You were looking at other opportunities, other.
Well, we did the R&D partnership on the. On the hyaluronic acid products. That became a big program.
Well, to bring in recombinant technology.
Oh yes, but also so Bob Carpenter played a big role in where Genzyme is today. So he went on the board because he was the CEO of, and he actually came into the company for a while. So for about a year, I initially reported to Henry, but Bob was put in between and I reported into Bob. Bob survived there for about a year and then didn't like reporting in to Henry. And stepped out of the company and started the sort of the angel investing group with the Baxter Boys that he does. And but he stayed on the board. But then with all that investing, he started a couple of companies that Genzyme eventually bought. So so the Renagel came from one of his companies, and then the there was a Biosurface Technologies was one of his that got bought in.
And were you there for that?
No, I'd left by then. I became CEO of Mitotics, so which was a cell cycle company. So.
And you were successful at Genzyme. You brought in all this stuff.
Yeah, Genzyme was great, but it became a very different organization. Once it became a big pseudo pharmaceutical company with you know, big sales. There was the old Wattman Reeve Angel business. But all those businesses turned into something else. So they had a pharmaceutical business, still making pharmaceutical intermediates. That was sold off. They had the diagnostic products business. So they didn't make the full package. They made the reagents that went to other companies that put in their kits to sell assays. So Dave Fleming headed that up. And then
were those antibodies they were making?
They made intermediates.
Oh, okay.
So sometimes they were the substrates for the enzymes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of pieces going to kits.
Right.
So there's two old businesses that were originally the original businesses in the UK. Both were kept going, and both turned into sort of businesses, but very small revenue-wise compared with Ceridase and the therapeutics division, and they were not profitable. I mean, they were always just break even, so they were tough, and that's why they before Sanofi bought, they were sold off, because Sanofi didn't want those pieces, they wanted the profitable piece.
But you felt like your job there was done?
No, I was recruited to be a CEO, and you know
that's you wanted to do that, yeah. And what about this opportunity was appealing?
My Mitotics was very interesting. It was cell cycle. So cancer cells are largely malignant because some of the controls that are involved when a cell divides into two are altered, and they're altered genetically, so they don't work. So there's a whole bunch of switches as a cell goes through the cycle of trying to divide into two. And they're called cyclins, so cyclin D, cyclin E, a lot of these. So Mitotics was focused on cloning the enzymes and the cyclins and working out with the ultimate goal was to develop some small molecules that would inhibit those, which presumably would be cancer drugs. So I went there, great science, raised what I believe at that time was the biggest Series B financing, and got the company well set up.
Well, you came in after A, or?
Yes, the company had no CEO. It had about 25, 30 people, was VC funded. And so the Series A was the original VC. I came in, did the Series B, expanded the group of investors that were in there. So we then had significant money. But it meant then basically you had to sit and watch while the science ticked along. And I hate to say it, but I found it rather boring sitting waiting for the science to work. And at about the same time, Cambridge Biotech, which at that time was the 10th largest biotech company in the world by sales, had been put into bankruptcy because of accounting fraud by the previous CEO. And the board there recruited me to come and do the turnaround of Cambridge Biotech. And that seemed to be an interesting challenge to me.
And it's a business challenge.
It was both.
Was it? Yeah. What was Cambridge? Before we go to that, I've also got Synaptic here. Was that in
between? Oh, that I was on the board of directors.
Oh, okay.
Just a board.
I see. Yeah.
So I was on that board for about 10 years with Jonathan Fleming from Oxford. So So Cambridge Biotech had a big diagnostics business. It had all the gold standard HIV testing. It sold a whole bunch of. It actually sold full kits, but then they went out.
Was this Bill Hazeltine?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, okay. He was involved in the early days of it, but he was gone by the time I was there. Mm-hmm. But it had built a huge business. I mean, it was, say, the 10th largest by sales. And of course, back then, that wasn't that big by today's standards. But it was mostly the diagnostic products that they sold. And they didn't go out under Cambridge Biotech label. So we sold a lot to bioMérieux. We sold to, Abbott. We made all the materials reagents that went into the kits again of those companies. And it had also had a reference lab, so it actually ran a lot of testing. And then it also had a therapeutics business, which was based on infectious diseases. So a lot of the diagnostic tests were also for infectious diseases as well. But it had an adjuvant called QS21. QS21, also called Stimulon, got a lot of other names. And it had some contracts with SmithKline Beecham. It had 15 clinical trials ongoing with partners using this adjuvant in vaccines to boost the immune system. So all it had there was sort of some research revenues behind it. It wasn't, the revenues mainly came from the diagnostics business. The CFO and the CEO that were fired had, when the company became profitable, they wanted to keep a nice smooth growth curve.
Yeah.
And of course, businesses aren't like that. So they fixed some of the dates on transactions. They altered things. The accountants found that, withdrew their opinion from, this is a public company, they withdrew their opinions, stock price drops. Company had to be put into Chapter 11 reorganization. And what the board realized was they needed someone who knew science, because you had to sort out, had four or five businesses, and you also need someone who knew business to be able to unravel the mess that had been created there. And to cut a long story short, we did turn the company around. The diagnostics business was not profitable when I joined. We had to make it profitable so we could sell it, because we had to raise money to get out of bankruptcy. You couldn't sell the therapeutics business because it was all still, stuff in the clinic and future. No one could value it properly. The diagnostics business, if you can make it profitable, you can do a PE ratio and you can put a hard value on it. So we turned that around, made it profitable, and then we sold it through a bankruptcy auction. Interesting process where the bankruptcy judge made me try and go and sell the business. I got all these bids in that were, we said low, low. So he did a bankruptcy auction, which is where he made them come to the court with a sealed envelope with their bids in a sealed envelope, and then he opened them in court and had agreed that that business would be sold to the highest bidder. Every one of the three or four companies that were serious came with bids that were now way up here. And interestingly, I can't remember the exact numbers, but one bid like 50 million, one bid 50 million and $1. Another one bid like 50 million and $10 and a royalty stream. But they all came like within cents of one another.
So.
One bid of just a round whole number. And then we knew we might get some funny things. The judge made us go into a back room. We were given 1 hour to evaluate these three concrete offers that were about the same, were all the same numbers, as to which was the most valuable to the creditors. And we had literally 1 hour to rumble through all these things. And we actually didn't go with the one that did the royalty streams, because there would be a gap and less surety that you would get it. We went with one of the others that said they'd pay an immediate stream of money, but a slightly lower number. And we went back to the judge and said, this is the one to take. And he took that one. So we eventually sold off all the diagnostic businesses and satisfied most of the creditors. We lost half the employees in the process because you couldn't hire employees. By the time we came out of bankruptcy, half the people in the company were contract employees because we couldn't hire permanently. But we brought it out as Aquila Biotherapeutics. which was all the vaccine and adjuvant business. So it's actually the same company, but we changed the name, we moved the location. You do everything you can to get rid of
any connotation.
The name, right. Everything. You don't want anything to do with that old history.
In the auction, was that the right valuation? What was your valuation?
We had to convert it all into a direct valuation, into dollars. We had to say, what's the best, because the dollars were going to be used to pay down debts and pay off creditors, and to partially fund the new company that was going to come out. They were going to be given shares in the new company as well.
Well, you must have had an idea what the figure was, and they're all at 50 million.
I don't remember the exact numbers, but I do remember how low the first bids were, and how much better, and how close they all were in their numbers.
But was it a surprise to get up here, or were you thinking?
No, because if we thought the numbers were still not a good deal, we would have told the bankruptcy judge this is still undervaluing. We were prepared to go. We had investment bankers that worked with us as advisors to help us value the stuff as we're breaking up the company. So we had lawyers and all sorts of people giving us advice as to what numbers we should accept or not accept.
So this is a very, for you, a very novel process.
Oh yeah, I learned. By the way, when Enron came along, everything Enron did, I was familiar with. All the off-balance sheet things, round trips. I mean, when you step into a company that's in bankruptcy because it had changed dates on some financial transactions, the trouble is, you know, a CEO's personality and style ripples through a company. And if the CEO is willing to be crooked, you find it ripples. I terminated everybody in the finance department. Because even though they'd got rid of the CFO, but nobody else, when I stepped in there and started sort of asking questions, I still remember the day where I talked to one of the most junior people in finance, and I'd questioned somebody's expense account report form. They had a consultant who just sent a bill in, where I looked at it, and he had phone calls when he was actually supposed to be on a plane, and this was before he had cell phones. I said, how can you be charging the company for a cell phone, for a phone call, which is made on the ground when you're in an airplane, and you're charging us for the... So I had someone in finance look at it in more detail, and they found lots of things. But I went in to talk to the fairly junior person, and I said, I can't believe someone put in a fake expense report form. And she sort of looked at me, and then she pulled open her bottom drawer, and she pulled out a stack of... She said, every one of these is false. And she collected records of them all. And I said to her, why didn't you say something about it? She said, I would have been fired. So Enron, fraud like that happens when it comes from the top. The stuff, and every place I turned over a stone, I found problems. I mean, it was a mess. So did I learn a lot? Yes. I learned about the myriad of ways that, in fact, companies can, in gray areas, interpret in slightly different ways. And the problem often is that the more junior people can't say much, or they'll say, are you really sure? But they can't say too much because they're worried about their jobs. And that's what was happening at Cambridge Biotech. So I terminated all the sort of, you know, only a very few at the very bottom were kept out of finance, because you have to get a clean slate. You have to be confident in people. The science was sound. The science of that company was superb. Jerry Belts was the head of R&D, and, you know, straight as a die. That's probably the main reason the company came out of bankruptcy and survived. And by the way, the technology, Aquila was then bought by Antigenix, which changed its name to AAGen or something. It still exists. But their biggest business is this adjuvant with SmithKline Beecham. It's in SmithKline Beecham's vaccines. So, but the science was solid, which is why Aquila could come out and survive and keep going as a standalone biotech company.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting story.
There's another whole story.
to that company?
Oh, yeah. A Cambridge Biotech is another whole story.
Oh, right.
You know, what goes right and what goes wrong.
I have a note here that you testified to a House committee on human cloning.
Where did you find all of this, by the way?
My assistant came up
she
with
did.
This.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I've testified on a lot of issues. I testified on SBIR grants way back when I was at Collaborative to try and get those formed. The biggest issue was that they were worried about, should a company have the patent rights? Because before, if you did a grant as a company, you got none of the patent rights. And that was the biggest change that went into SBIRs, was giving the companies the patent rights, because then they would commercialize it.
And that's the issue you spoke
I testified on that one. I testified on the price of drugs with Henry at Genzyme.
Yeah.
I testified for the recombinant DNA advisory committee. On safety and what we should be doing about trying to get ordinances and how to control and how to manage it. I mean, I've testified on several different things over the years.
I recall I wanted to ask you a question about Lexington and maybe Waltham, where you were talking to the city officials there.
Yep.
And What were their attitudes? I mean, they're waiting to see what Cambridge is doing, but I mean, they also want to get to business, right?
So. Exactly, and that was their big dilemma. Their local people back then were very scared of, as the Cambridge newspapers would write about, we were going to have green monsters running around, coming out of the drains and running around Cambridge. Literally, they would write about that stuff. So the citizens of these towns were going, you mean it's already ongoing here, and we're going to get infections and all sorts of things. I mean, their populations were scared. So a lot of it, we had to do a lot of public meetings where we would go and talk and try and explain what we were doing in very simple language so that people wouldn't be scared. But also then we'd go into the council meetings. We actually had to help write the language they wanted in there where it would meet their needs and meet our needs at the same time. So in each of those two towns, it took well over a year of hand-holding and doing things. And for a long time, we had the facility in Lexington, but couldn't do recombinant DNA work there, but we could still do it in Waltham.
So it never shut you down completely.
Yeah, it would. Oh, yeah.
But it didn't shut you down completely.
It didn't, because we eventually got it, and then we moved the whole company to Lexington. So the whole company eventually moved. But there was an overlap period, because it took time to get the ordinances in.
And did they, in fact, wait for Cambridge to make it?
I believe they were after Cambridge. Yeah. Cambridge was the first.
Yeah.
And Cambridge, by then, by the way, was the most restrictive. So we actually almost had an advantage once, because we were out in the suburbs, once we got legislation in these two towns. So that's also why Lexington and Waltham have become reasonable hubs of biotech, because they did it early and much simpler regulations than Cambridge.
You're with Cambridge Biotech to about 2000, and then once more onto something else?
Yes.
CMT?
Catharsis Medical Technology. It's a device company, VC funded. It actually was started by a nurse who'd had a medical error when she was in her own hospital. And it was a drug error, so she developed a technology that involved putting a barcode on a patient, a barcode on a drug, and a barcode on the infusion pump, so that they could be scanned and checked against a database that would then say, is this drug in the right patient, at the right time, at the right dose, and is it compatible with the other drugs that the patient is on? So a forerunner of what today is now universal in hospitals, and CVS even does it. If you go to CVS, they will, and you do or get all your drugs through CVS, they will have checked in your database to make sure that what that doctor prescribed for you doesn't interfere what that one does. But she had a medical error on herself and went out and started this company. So
how did you get involved with it originally?
I don't actually fully remember how I got totally in contact with them. There was one VC behind them. He put a lot of money in it. And I spent a lot of time with them. I was only half time with them, I believe, because they didn't have the money. And very soon after that, I also started Ribonovics with another group. But the biggest problem with CMT was that most hospitals fully admitted they needed the technology, but they weren't willing to buy from a small company. And I now realize, you know, the small company, because it involves changing medical practice, there are huge liability issues. And the hospitals wouldn't buy from the small company.
Because
the small company hasn't got deep enough pockets to provide, could be gone, but couldn't also provide the liability if there was a big liability claim.
Because their name is going to be on the suit too?
Yeah.
They become
Well, I'm on the board of Children's Hospital. We have Cerner does the IT system at Children's. When we signed the first contract with Cerner, we demanded that they put a $13 billion bond out. Because Children's, if there's a problem with the IT system, Children's sued, and it turns out Cerner's done something wrong, they want to have something. So Children's demanded a huge bond off a huge company. They will never buy from a little startup. And it's a lesson I still find I have to tell entrepreneurs who think they got the latest, biggest, you know, gizmo that will. They'll die to have it. But if you're a small company, it's very hard to sell. They can't take the risk. Yeah. So CMT fell into that trap. So I stopped working with them after a while because it wasn't going anywhere. And I'd also started Ribonovics with Phil Cunningham out of Wayne State. So Ribonovics came because I was on the advisory board for, I gave a talk out in Michigan so this is like 10 years ago. I gave a talk because they wanted to try and build a biotech business. They had a lot of pharmaceuticals. You know, Pfizer had lots of stuff, but Pfizer got in there by buying all the other pharmaceutical companies and consolidating and cutting back. So they wanted to try and build a biotech business there. So the state founded some venture capital funds, and one of them was called Arboretum Ventures. And when I went out to give a talk on how to get into biotech to this group, Arboretum Ventures approached me and asked me to be on their advisory board. But at the same time, Wayne State said, we got a professor here with some nice technology, will you evaluate it and tell us whether we should form a company? Mm-hmm. And I and a group that actually came out of Cambridge Biotech took a look at it, and we decided that it actually was a good technology, that it should be commercialized, and they should form a company around it. So then they asked us to in fact do that. So that's how I got involved in that one.
And this is an alternative to antibiotics, is that what the...
It's a technology that allows you to understand what mutations occur in ribosomal RNA that will interfere with the ribosome functioning. Most antibiotics, many of them, 150% work because they bind to the RNA in the ribosome and they stop the RNA functioning. Mm-hmm. What the bugs do is they just randomly mutate. And if they can get a mutation in a site where the antibiotic binds, then it won't bind, you get drug resistance, but now the bug can keep growing. So what you need to do with an antibiotic is not just target any old site in the ribosome, you've got to target sites that are essential for ribosome function. Because if you block that, it can mutate it, but then the ribosome can't work either. So you'd have really good antibiotics. So Phil Cunningham had developed this technology to in fact target the critical regions of the ribosomal RNA. So we formed Ribonovics around that technology to develop it. We got a lot of grants in, we got significant interest from the pharmaceutical industry, but by now the industry had evolved from not just finding the site to you got to find the drug that works on it, you got to have the molecule that binds. And we found molecules that bound, but we could never get enough funding to really develop them properly. And so eventually the technology's gone back to Wayne State University and they're going to develop it further. So that's another challenge that's in our industry. I mean, today no one wants it unless it's in the clinic. Mm-hmm. And that chasm going from research to the clinic, Ribonovics couldn't get over it, mm-hmm. so it went back into the university lab.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas for solutions there? Alternate?
No, if I had,
yes,
I'd be
amazed.
Because everybody's got that problem.
Yes.
And it's a big problem. It really mm-hmm. is. I mean, here we have the Mass Life Science Center, MLSC. where the state's putting money in to try and give grants to try and fill that gap.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is, you know, the state does a great job with that, but they tend to only fund things that are getting funding from somewhere else at the same time.
Mm.
No one wants to be the lone funder, too big a risk.
Yeah.
Because if they lost the money, the state would shut down that activity.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge how to do really innovative, high-risk research, because when it comes down to it, the majority of it doesn't work. I mean, the majority fails.
Mm-hmm.
And even the VCs of the last 10 years have all lost money.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
Well, maybe public funding is one way to go on it. Well, maybe to teach. I mean, if basically you have taxpayers subsidizing orphan drugs.
Yep. Yeah,
maybe
you're right.
Subsidize if you want innovation, you want private.
I know. I don't know what the answer. The trouble is, the gap can be as much as a 10-year gap. Too.
Yes, no, that's yeah.
See, that's the biggest problem. It's not the VC's cycle is typically they want to be in and out in 5 years. So does public funding. I'm on a mutual fund board. The average time span that mutual fund PMs, portfolio managers, hold it, less than a year.
Mm.
I mean, they want instant jump in the stock price, and they're gone. And the most they'll do is 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest problem is, see, in the old model used to be you clone your gene, go public. The public funded getting into the early clinic, then pharma picked it up in the early clinic. That public funding went from that middle piece.
Right.
And there's been no substitute.
Mm-hmm.
We've still got these pieces, but...
It's a dilemma, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody will innovate, do some financial innovation.
No, but unless they can get a return on their money, because you got to remember, all they're in it for is the money.
Well, yeah.
They'll give you this about great things they do, but...
Well, we'll see what happens and hope.
Yep,
to go forward.
I know. So now I haven't worked for any one company now for probably 2 years,
mm-hmm.
2+ years. I'm on 5 boards, 3 are in healthcare, 2 are in financial services.
And what is this? This
is one of the companies I'm on the board of, Apt Associates. It's a company that does research and technical assistance, largely government funding behind it. 60% of the work is
so
healthcare.
Does contract research? Or?
No, it works for USAID. So when the US government says it's giving, you know, financial aid to certain countries, they don't send money. What they do is they set up programs where a company like Apt will bid on running the program, and then they will actually run it. So we just came back from 5 days in Dominican Republic, where we were visiting some of the projects that Apt runs for USAID. They're trying to improve the healthcare system in Dominican Republic. So that's how. When the foreign aid is given to the Dominican Republic, it isn't money that's sent to the DR, to their government,
because
you never do that. So Apt does third world health, because largely it's third world where that money goes. They do a lot of US health as well, but they have a division called Apt SRBI. It does it's a survey group, and they do all the vaccine surveys, for example. So when you find out, you hear all this about X percent of the population has been vaccinated, that's Apt SRBI behind those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of education work, so they've been evaluating Head Start programs, No Child Left Behind. They do a lot of food security now. So food security, we've visited some a chocolate factory in the Dominican Republic, which sounds fancy, but it's a room this big where a group of 50 women in a village, USAID bought them the machine that lets them grind the beans and actually make chocolate.
So they get
more of the value add, because when they sell the beans, the farmers get a bit, but their wives, by the way, get none of that. So the women wanted to take it one step downstream. So Apt set up they went in and set up all the... So those are part of food security. So we went to Mali 3 years ago. We visited some villages where Apt built dams across streams so they go across fields to flood them so they grow rice, and brought in actually biotech, strains of rice, quality biotech. But because they won't grow in that region normally, so they bring in strains that will grow. and help the women of the village grow rice. The men all herd cattle.
And when you say quietly, I mean, are there regulators there? You know, or do they have policies? I mean, lots of places just have these blanket policies.
No policies whatsoever. Yeah. And by the way, the reason they're so, I never realized this, the reason Mali is such a poor country is that the government officially owns all the land, and they rent it to the farmers. If you rent the land, you don't take care of it. You strip it of all its nutrients. You have a 5-year lease, strip it of the nutrients for your crop and move on. So that's the reason they have such problems growing things. And a lot of African countries, I didn't realize, farmers don't own their land. So they have no long-term vested interest.
And the governments are not listening to economic advisors.
There's no way the governments will change who owns the land. That's their main source of revenue. They don't pay income taxes. Think of a third world country.
Think where
you know, you're out in the villages. A whole different economy.
Right.
But that's the work ACT does, and I've been on this board for about 10 years. So all these people here, they are the program managers. ACT has more employees outside of America than it does inside, but they're all in these places where you don't go on vacation. So Pakistan, Vietnam, a lot of Indochina, Bolivia. We have a lot of malaria projects in South America, Mexico, several projects in Mexico. So the people here are the sort of, they are the ones who oversee and run these projects. There's a lot of expats out in the field as well. But it's a great company because it's like my biotech industry, it's mission-driven. A lot of the people who work here are former Peace Corps volunteers, Teach for America, all those. They're people whose just their mission in life is to improve, the mission of this company is to improve the well-being of people worldwide. Mm-hmm. The well-being and health of people worldwide, because health is such a big piece of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you heard about this appeal to you when you heard and learned about it?
I've known the CEO of this company for about 20 years, and I know Clark Apt, the original founder, I've known him for 20 years.
I see.
And they asked me to come on the board. As I say, I've been on it for 10 or 11 years. Mm-hmm. So, and then I'm on the board of Healthways, which does health and wellness management. So it actually is behind a lot of the programs that your either big company employers or health plans put in wellness programs. They actually come from a company like Healthways. So they do that. And then Children's Hospital in Boston, where I run this morning I was there at the patient care meeting. I oversee all the safety, quality, and service of the hospital. So that's wonderful work to do. I mean, it's just heartbreaking when you see some of these little kids with some of the problems they have. And then I'm on Columbia Funds, which is a mutual fund, and then ICI Mutual, which is an insurance company. And I end up on those because being a biotech CEO, you learn so much about how to finance a company, how to raise money. You know, when the chairman of the board of Columbia first approached me, I met him in Boston. He said, "I bet you've never been to Minneapolis, because that's where the board's headquartered." And I said, "Oh, about 100 times. and I reeled off a whole long list of the portfolio managers that I'd been selling biotech stocks to them, and of course they buy them. And he realized it would be good to have someone who was a buyer. You know, they're the buyers. It'd be good to have someone who'd been selling to them on the other side of the table." Mm-hmm. So that's why I ended up on that board. So I just do board work, and then I do. I work with several VC groups. I work with Mass Life Science Center on their programs, Springboard, which does tries to mentor women entrepreneurs.
Who's involved in that?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, Springboard's, it does a lot of IT as well as health.
Uh-huh.
And it's focused heavily on women. I mean, a lot of what I do is women.
Is it Kendall Square?
No, it's based in New York.
Oh, okay.
No, you are. And then I've worked with BSCP, which is the Biomedical Careers Program here, trying to help minorities get careers in life sciences and medicine. So I do a lot of those volunteer things as well, which is why I have some flexibility to meet people like you.
Well, thank you so much. A wonderfully varied career.
Fun.
Yeah.
Oh, I've always had fun. I've been able to work on you know, great science, great products, and great people. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've always enjoyed what I do. Mm-hmm. And I learn from all of them. I mean, you've got to keep learning. They're all places where I hope I can give to as well. So it's just been, it's good. Mm-hmm. And I never want to stop working.
Yeah, good. There's no reason why you should.
Right.
If it sponsors, it makes you happy.
Yep.
And
it does.
And you're doing good work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Okay. So
some bits you're going to have to not, you know.
Right.